Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a podcast about all things digital assets, the global communities they are creating, the generations that are using and investing in them, and the challenges faced by the nations that are seeking to regulate them. The content of this program is not to be taken as investment advice. The opinions expressed in the program by the host and the guests are their personal opinions only. Remember, feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. My name is Derek Graham. I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management, and my co-host is Nitin Gower, Managing Director of State Street Digital Assets. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome along to another episode of Beyond Bitcoin. My name is Derek Graham. I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management. Of course, I'm here with my friend and colleague, Nitin Gower, and CTO of Portal Asset Management. Hey, Nitin, how are you?
Hey, Derek. Glad to be here. I know we had a short break, largely because of my travels. And a little bit more about travel. I think one aspect of Beyond Bitcoin is to bring the global perspective. Yes. Super interesting conversation today. I believe we have a guest who also has a global perspective, actually a very interesting one. So looking forward to this conversation today. I've been actually looking forward to it for quite some time. So shortly introduce our guest and jump right into it.
Terrific. So in fact, our guest is going to help shatter the belief that cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin specifically, traditionally, is being used to launder and pay for drugs. It is so far from reality today. So here's some interesting statements made, because facts, we'll have to discuss those along the way, but these are statements made by the United Nations Office of Drug and Crime. And they estimate that between 2 and 5% of global GDP is laundered each year. So to give you an idea, their estimate of that is somewhere around 772 billion to 2.2%, $2.2 trillion US dollars a year is laundered and is illicit. And then on the other hand, in this particular space, Chainalysis analyzes all the layer one protocols, the blockchains, and they report every year of what is considered to be illicit transactions in the crypto asset, cryptocurrency world. And in 2023, their estimate was about $24.2 billion of transactions were illicit. And that is 0.34% of the total turnover. And as I say again, and I'm not recommending this, but if you're a drug dealer out there listening to this, stick with US dollar cash. It's such a good transfer mechanism. Don't bother about Bitcoin with and blockchain with immutable accounting transactions that stay forever and can be tracked. And so today we've got a guest that I'm going to let Nitin introduce. He's going to carry on how important it is to be able to be accountable and analyze KYC and AML transactions that are coming in. Over to you, Nitin.
Yeah, thank you, Derek. And again, without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Guillermo, a really good friend of mine. I actually interfaced with Guillermo when I was at State Street, when we were trying to evaluate, I would say, about 30 plus different startups. And Guillermo's work stuck out only because he was trying to solve some unique problem in the industry. And I think it's very, you know, pertaining to our conversation in terms of blockchain analytics, which is a constantly growing field. While Chain Analysis, DRM Labs, and Elliptic the world have attempted to make it simpler, there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of technology, there's a lot of nuances to this industry. So Guillermo, welcome to Beyond Bitcoin. Really glad to have you on this podcast, and love to get your perspective on your vision, your genesis of how you got to this point. I believe you're a recovering banker, as we have had a conversation. So you understand financial services, you understand the challenges of the existing financial system. And this topic, I would say, Guillermo, is very pertinent, especially given where things were in terms of some of the claims that Senator Warren had made in terms of, you know, the use of Bitcoin for illicit finance, starting from Hamas to various sort of elements in congressional inquiries and so on and so forth. So shed some light on one, your thinking, your genesis of how you got into the space and what was your journey, and then expand on how you see the claims being made, and since you're so close to the wire, so to speak, I'd love to get your perspective on that, Guillermo. So over to you and welcome.
Nitin and Derek, thank you very much, first of all, for opening up a space to tell the story and for the interest, and beyond grateful, Nitin, once again, for all your support throughout this time, not only now, but from the State Street days as well. I'm going to begin by doing something a bit dynamic, which is, Derek, those both numbers that you mentioned, both the Chainalysis and the UN one, are wrong. And they're not purposely wrong. I think they're doing a good effort at trying to assess something. But first, neither number includes each other, right? The UN is focusing on money laundering on the traditional financial system, and it's completely ignoring whatever on-chain information is happening. So that, you know, top $2 trillion, it's not considering what we see on digital assets. And the digital assets number, it's massively undercalculated because that's only on-chain to on-chain activity. And it does not take into consideration the fact that you could go to some politician and offer some, you know, cryptocurrency in exchange for favors, right? A bribe or corruption. It does not take into consideration numbers such as the $23 billion scam that we pointed towards in April of last year in Venezuela. We were the company to reveal that the regulator in Venezuela dedicated for cryptocurrency activity. For those that don't know in the podcast, Venezuela was one of the first countries worldwide to adopt a national cryptocurrency called the Petro. It was an absolute failed attempt, but it didn't fail because of technical details. It failed because of cultural and government corruption nuances. So nothing about the technical side of it was wrong. What was wrong about it was implementation once it hit, you know, once it hit the market, and it shortly after got OFAC sanctioned and et cetera, et cetera. But at the end, the local regulator was allowing itself and actually sort of facilitating the sanction avoidance methodology for oil sales from Venezuela. But because they were doing it using crypto, they were using some random person's names. Like they would say, Derek, now you're responsible for selling, you know, 50,000 barrels a day. And like, it's up to you how you collect on that payment. And in the future, we're going to go back to you and demand our money. So crypto started being used for that. That 23 billion figure, it's nowhere in that Chainalysis report, and it will not be in any of these other reports. So what I'm trying to get at is that it doesn't take into consideration the off-chain slash real-world dynamics of business transactions, or in this case, illegitimate business transactions, to legitimate business transactions. So if you steal some money and with that money buy cryptocurrencies, that's not factored in. In neither number. It's not factoring in the UN number, and it's not factoring in the, you know, I don't want to pick specifically on Chainalysis because each Elliptic produces a report too, and TRM does it as well. And I believe CipherTrace has done some throughout the years, and neither of them are able to get it right. Something that is accurate is the fact that the percentage of crypto illicit activity as total activity on the network, it's probably smaller than what it is in the US dollars. And there's several reasons for that. Number one, it takes certain technical knowledge for you to really be able to move around large numbers of cryptocurrency. So if you're just moving around a couple of $1,000, that's very easy, risk is low, etc. But if you are, you know, some big time hacker and you want to move around 600 or 900 million or a billion, like there's a lot of eyes looking at that. So you're not going to want to put that on an exchange. And if you're not doing that route, it takes some really technical ability to do it. And not all truth is that not all criminals like have it. And the other one is that basically like every single criminal activity that we know of, it's at some point associated with US dollar anyways. Like when was the last time that you read on the news, you know, narco or drug lord or, you know, some bad guy catched with 100% Bitcoin holdings? Like normally they have USD in some wallet or in some, so you know, like that's a preface basically to the conversation.
So one thing on this, let me double click a little bit on this piece, right? Because when I was prior to State Street, when I was working at IBM, as we discussed, Guillermo, in the past, I was looking at a few things, right? We use something called FCI, which is Financial Crimes Intelligence Platform, is trying to amalgamate the on-chain activity, which is the blockchain-based transactions, to off-chain activity. So figuring out the on-ramp, off-ramp, which is where the Operation Choke Point 2.0, which is figuring out the ability for the system, the financial system, the political system, to not only regulate, but sort of nudge the industry to say, let's stop banking, because once you stop the on-ramp, off-ramp, on-chain activity remain contained, and the effort that's needed for us to correlate those two data becomes a lot more simpler. But it is largely to sort of choke the growth of crypto industry in general. So from that perspective, is that analysis become better or faster? Because I know you've traveled to a lot of, you know, Central America, South America, and your heritage being Venezuelan, and you having worked in Miami, which is a very interesting place from a banking perspective, being in South America and being the nexus of the South American injection of, you know, finance coming into the U.S. Shed a light of that experience and how that led you to the challenges, because it's been touted that blockchains are easy to analyze because it's a linked list of transactions, and all I had to do is find the right patterns. And I've always said this as finding the patterns and connecting dots. It's a lot easier if it's on chain. Things become really complicated when you're now dealing with multiple ecosystems in blockchain, but also the existing financial system, which, as we know, is quite complex, only because it's not as digital and not as well connected as blockchains are. So I'll pause here and see, Guillermo, what's your perspective?
So quick background: born and raised in Venezuela, immigrant parents, formal schooling here in the United States. Started working in 2012 as an investment banker for Citibank. I had been managing personal investments and some family money before that. So I've been in the banking industry for about 15 years now, always as an investor. I started with the investment banking, which is dedicated to the corporate world. And then I switched over, I moved to Miami from New York and started, actually handled a family business for about 3 years that wasn't doing great. Took that out and basically made it survive, and it's now thriving. Withdraw from it and started a private banking book. So when Nitin says that I'm a recovered banker 100%, it took a toll on me. Like I now have even gray hairs, you know, and I'm younger than I should be for that. But the big thing that I learned, it's how complicated compliance was. And the reason why I had to learn that, it's because when you're moving money among US citizens inside the US, honestly, like, compliance is very straightforward. Like, all you're really caring for, it's that your client is not doing something massively stupid, like financing terrorism or like child pornography or something like that. But like, aside from that, the risks are very well defined and are very easy to analyze. Things massively change once you start banking foreigners. So anybody that does not have a social security number automatically triggers into a different category of risk for the US. That was 100% of my book of business. So I managed $100 million or close to $100 million in investments. And then I was responsible for a multifamily office out of Central America with $820 million. So that's almost $1 billion in responsibility. Zero US clients. All of it was Central America, Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. If there's one thing that all of that has in common, is that none of those currencies work. Nobody in those countries want their currency. And I happen to have lived through a very particular time where the Brazil reais was going ballistic, and it depreciated 45 or 50% in 2 years. Yeah. The Argentinian peso, I lost track of how many like numbers they had to add to it. And in that in between, Venezuela removed 14 zeros from their currency.
Just, wow.
I want to take a second for people who are listening to us. Imagine a bill, write 14 zeros and some number in front of it, and then remove them all. Like, how big of a hyperinflation problem we have. So cryptocurrencies, yes, in those countries were a methodology for a ton of people to have access to the US dollar. So people weren't striving back in 2014, 15, 16. People weren't like saving Bitcoin. Like that was not their ethos in Venezuela for most people. Obviously, some people who were there and understood it really wanted to hold on to it. But most people were just a vehicle of transition towards a harder currency to what they were having in their country. So you would use local Bitcoin or Mercado Bitcoin in Brazil or some other version of a peer-to-peer market, some exchanges too, to transition from your local currency into magic internet money. And from magic internet money, then you would offload into some quote-unquote first world currency. And that's actually my origin story. Yeah. I started using Bitcoin specifically for that purpose in 2012. At some point throughout the journey, I realized that if I didn't sell immediately and I held on to it for 2 days or 3 days or maybe a week, I was making money. So something very curious happened where I said, well, what happens if I just like don't sell it for 2 weeks and then five and then a year and then, you know, and then, well, we all can take it from there.
Exactly. Hey, Guillermo,
one thing on this one,
asset management runs two funds. One is its fund of funds, which is a digital, you know, asset fund of funds. And the other one is a direct investment fund and based out of the UK. And the KYC and the AML and the paperwork associated with applying, particularly to the Radiance fund, is quite extensive because it's a global fund and the investors are all around the world. When I went through the process of cornerstoning that fund and investing into it, I was amazed how old and draconian and outdated the KYC and the AML process was, how much paperwork, wet signatures is associated with it. It was you know, something that could do with improvement, and they are going through that process. But you guys are talking about utilizing artificial intelligence to be able to validate with KYC and AML banking customers. This to me is a fabulous breakthrough, and I'd really like to learn more about that.
Absolutely. So we actually see the world and the direction that things are heading towards a world where KYC becomes irrelevant. And the reason why I say that, it's because having been inside a bank in the United States, but my true expertise as a banker was moving money around the world. Okay. And there's a fine line, very gray, between doing that and some illicit activity. Because basically it's the same process. What differentiates both, it's who you are doing it for. Are you able to understand that your client, it's a legitimate business person, and not that you're money laundering and abetting some, you know, bad person? But talk to me about anywhere in the world where you can quote unquote, you know, hide your money, and I'm very familiar with how that looks. The problem with that is that then you start to understand that there is an ingrained benefit in the system for having all these really old school KYC things applied. And we've gotten to a point where you can generate synthetic identities. There are hundreds of websites on the dark web that will sell you a synthetic identity. And all you have to do is get on some, you know, generative AI model and basically say, hey, show me a picture for a, you know, Italian male with black hair. And next thing you know, you have exactly the picture that matches the synthetic identity that you bought on the dark web. And you have a person that has some valid address. So the whole KYC component will be probably proven to be obsolete under the current advances of technology. So the way that we approach it, it's how does the anti-money laundering and how does the risk mitigation component for our industry has to look like in a world where you can just cheat the whole system? And
yeah,
my definition.
So one thing on this, right? Go ahead, sorry.
Anything. I was going to say that my definition of it is that we should care less about, and we will probably care in the direction of less about KYC, like know your customer, to something that I call KY be. And the way we define that, it's know your behavior. So it's going to matter less who my customer is in terms of like name, race, gender, etc. And it's going to matter significantly more what is my customer using their account for? What are they doing in their interaction with my institution? And that's the part that we're great at.
So one thing on this, right? Help us understand a little bit, talk about block clients, which again, I have touched upon it when we were working with you. And of course, there are the big players, or they have become big over time because of their work. Chain analysis, for example, we cite them often on this podcast. Their analysis in terms of crypto penetration, crypto usage around the world. We worked with TRM Labs and Elliptic in the past, both in terms of compliance. When I say compliance, you're exactly right. We are basically trying to at least do the bare minimum. In fact, I think KYC and sanctions check has become more of a process to say, hey, we've done all the DD and no red flags. In fact, there's very little of a true sense of analysis that goes. Basically, people are looking for red flags, and the red flags is a process, and people follow the process. And I think to my last analysis, I believe only 45% of financial crimes are prosecuted in spite of having all the tech, and 55% are just let go either because they're too small to care about and so on and so forth. So I'd love to understand how block clients is different from the so-called big players, the TRM and the Elliptic of the world. And besides the, you know, besides the analysis that you perform from block clients, Guillermo, you know, if you look at chain analysis, they have two aspects of it. One aspect is, again, financial crimes analysis and providing that solutioning to corporates and banking. And the other is what we use is utility. How much of blockchain is being used around the world. And so is BlockPlients trying to penetrate those things? How are you trying to be different from these players?
So we don't currently have a proprietary research team, so we're not publishing information.
Of course.
As a matter of fact, we actually deeply believe that TRM and Chainalysis both have phenomenal research units. There's also some research coming out of Onyx, JP Morgan's blockchain division, that is worth taking a look at. But the reality, it's that they're winning at that point, and I don't see any scenario where we would want to compete for data. I think that we need to focus exactly what we're very strong at, and that's in the services that we sell. What we are great at, it's more on the preactive measure. So far, the industry, the banking industry and the investments industry has been using reactive tools, such as Chainalysis Reactor and TRM's navigation system and Elliptic Lens to understand and trace coins. That's an effort that not only is it time consuming, but it's very expensive in terms of the type of licenses you have to get from their software and the type of personnel, human capital that you have to have. And it's highly specialized human capital. You can't just put, you know, like these people need some training to understand the nuances, at least, of what crypto is and compliance and regulations. So we want to democratize the access to the risk assessment by bringing it just to your normal compliance employee in a way that does not require deep asset tracing methodologies. And the way that we did that is by thinking about it proactively instead of reactively. So are you with... Does your company have the needs to do reactive investigations and asset trace and do forensic analysis? By all means, please hire one of these companies. They're great at it. We'll be happy to connect you with our folks there. But are you in the business that requires you to understand whether your client is using the money for good or not, whether you should file a suspicious activity report, or whether you just like want to open an account for this person? Then come to us. Because that's the answer we can get to you within 1 to 3 seconds. You type up an address that belongs to the customer's wallet, or magic wonders of the internet or computers would use AI and machine learning to do some risk assessments on the counterparties, the type of rig, the type of transaction, and OSINT intelligence that we know about that wallet and its transactional context. And then we'll come up with a score, which we call the compliance, the block compliance score, from A to F, color-coded, very simple. Again, trying to make it as friendly as possible for the person who is not crypto native. Like, where block compliance is great at, it's grabbing your traditional bank compliance person that would hate crypto and don't want to see it and thinks it's for scammers, and make them able to now risk assess crypto stuff with colors that they feel familiar and are not intimidating, so your institution can start to accept money from the crypto folks that come from exchanges, etc.
Which is an inevitable requirement, and I'm really excited about this, because the fact of the matter is that if you're creating something that traditional finance is starting to become confident in, and they're saying, look, we've done all the checks, there's the report, off we go. And you can generate that in a few seconds. And you can do that, no doubt, in due course. You could probably provide the list of all the wallets that they're dealing with. It'll just generate reports en masse so that it's actually outlining every single transaction there. The bank gets to audit the process and it gets to report against it. And this is another important bridge, the way I see it, to traditional finance and to the world of cryptocurrencies and decentralized finance, etc. These bridges are core. Now, one thing also, Guillermo, is that you've talked about the fact that you've developed this, you know, block appliance yourself, your software, and you've got a team of people that are working on software, and you're now continuing to build that. And we always like to support, you know, early stage startup companies, clever people. Nitin knows you well. In fact, State Street were one of your first customers that were involved with it. I understand that you're going to do a next step raising through this particular process. So, I mean, there's lots of people that listen to this. If this is an area that, you know, as a professional group of investors might like to investigate, maybe they should contact you. Might mention that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're starting actually our seed fundraise, which is going to be our first institutional raise, with the intention of taking this to a next level. We want to be able to service multi-assets on it. And something that we are particularly keen of is the fact that the market that we are following, Derek, it's vast, but it's slow to react. To put things in perspective,
yeah,
the US has over 3,300 registered FDIC members. Only 25 of those that we know of are using some sort of chain analytics software in their compliance process. And that's
wow,
only US.
Wow. That's big.
Yeah. But at the same time, banks and governments, because it's a type, we basically service banks, exchanges, government or government agencies. Neither of those are like particularly fast to make decisions. So it's taken us a while to achieve, you know, governments as clients, which we have one, regulators as clients, police units as clients, like those type of clients are, I think that's where we really are going to excel, in the fact that we are being able to bridge and just bring this compliance stuff to people who would 2 years ago say, we're never going to do that. Now we're opening up that market. And at the end, it's all about adoption, right? I'm a firm believer that Bitcoin at 100,000 is possible and will probably happen, but will not happen without a further increase in regulation and compliance, because we need large institutions to jump in with the big checks. And that's not going to happen if the regulatory scope doesn't define well whether they can do it or not. And that will bring compliance.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think even, you know, your assertion, you know, as the ETF opens up a lot of institutional flow of capital, and we see on a weekly basis the previous number being shattered as early as last week with 2.2 billion has flown again, yet again, which has been the largest so far this week. So I think you're absolutely right, Guillermo, that for it to actually go to the next level, you do need to actually ensure that the industry, the regulators, the enforcement agencies are comfortable with these platforms and understand these. But at the same time, I think that, as you described the landscape, that there are a lot of de novo institutional investors like us. You know, we are a small sort of four people aspiring to grow rapidly. And Coinbase boasts of 11,000 different institutional clients, at some point, when you reach a certain threshold, your KYC AML becomes paramount. You have to do it only because of the fact that you have additional regulatory sort of scrutiny around it. So certainly an interesting space that you have lodged yourself into, Guillermo, only because I think everybody just talks about three or four. There is certainly space for a lot more innovation and a lot more different thinking around to say not everybody wants to do KYC AML for reporting purposes. The agencies, law enforcement, and the governments, you've worked with El Salvador and Venezuela, I think, they all want to have a consistent ebb and flow of information just for the sake of understanding the industry and following through, not necessarily for integrating to into a RegTech or regulatory sort of
Yeah,
system per se, I think.
we've also done some stuff with Panama and Dominican Republic and Brazil, and like basically if you're a government agency and you're curious about understanding how this space looks like for you in your daily activities, that we're happy to entertain that conversation. It might be that you want to use the services for something, but it might be that you don't, but you just want to have a path to understanding how this technology is being used in your, in your geography, and we're particularly keen to entertain that. Again, I'm a Bitcoiner myself, right? Like I've been in this for more than a decade now, which is crazy to say. And long time ago, I already went over the whole like Bitcoin maxi thing because I understand that Bitcoin on its own, it's not a vacuum. For us to go, to the moon and to the million and all these things, they can only happen in the context of the financial world that we live through. And that will
Yes.
come with banks jumping on. I think, Nitin, to your point about the ETF, ETF is great. I really like it. And I think that anyone who wants to hold Bitcoin and is curious about it, but what scares that person or that individual or that group or that company from holding Bitcoin is the technology component of it. Please buy the ETF is the best way to do it because somebody will bear the risk of the custody. But for large institutional investors, your Fortune, 100, ETF is just a path towards in the future having self-custody. Because why would you pay
Absolutely.
a quarter? Yeah, why would you pay a quarter of a point for somebody to hold your cash on balance kind of thing? So 10 years from now or whatever time frame, people would jump into the ETF first, and at some point the current CTO or the current finance guy or gal are gonna be like, why are we paying this fee? We could just pocket this money if we hold it ourselves, and that's gonna happen.
Yeah. And Germán, the other thing we're also going to see
Interesting.
is that the natural progression of the generation that's coming forward. And I see that the ETF, very important at this stage in history, will ultimately become an outdated technology. And the generation to come will have no reason to use it, and they'll see the benefit of bearer assets. But the road to that time is filled with many needs of reply of solutions that are necessary for the institutions to be able to participate in this space. So we welcome the concept of it, but we think it's going to be an aging technology. What's very important from this conversation is a few percentages that you've quoted. When you turn around and said 25 of the 3,300 banking groups in the US have sufficient compliance systems around digital assets, it just goes to show you how young the space continues to be. How the parallel existence of traditional finance and DeFi and crypto finance is not yet fully engaged with each other. Building bridges and what Nitin and I called on-ramps and off-ramps to this space is so incredibly important. And what you're doing in regards to building a bridge to enable automated KYC and AML and other validity checks is so important for getting these big bank organizations comfortable. So I think you play a very important role in the ecosystem, and I greatly appreciate you coming along and explaining that to us and to our listeners today.
Oh, please, Derek, we're happy to do so. But we've actually bet more on the smaller banks. We think that at the end of the day, like, your Bank of America's and your JP Morgan's and Goldman Sachs, the nature of their business is that they can pay a $500 million fine. They probably just like have a line item on their balance sheet that says business as usual, right? At this point, because they get fined like every year. So the problem is more like what happens to your local banking institution, the one that can't afford to pay a fine like that. And those are the guys that we think we're great at servicing. And unfortunately, right now they don't have, and they're not adopting technology this way. But they are now coming to the realization that they are crypto exposed. And one of the voluntary FinCEN declarations for last year was banks, member banks needed to understand and report what their customers' activity on crypto was basically. And they what FinCEN was trying to get at, it's basically trying to understand how big the percentage of people within the banking industry in the US are linking their bank accounts to crypto. The way it was worded was a bit weird, and it ended up in the whole thing where, like nobody really reported, and some it was just a bit weird, but they fixed it for 2024. So now there's a voluntary process that the industry is going forward of understanding how does crypto exposure is affecting banks. And it's just a matter of time before the two systems are too ingrained together for us to even make a distinction on it.
So, how do our listeners finally catch up with you after this? What's the best way of contacting you?
I can be reached directly at G Fernandez, ending with an S, at blockclients.com, through the website, through LinkedIn, through Twitter. Any of those routes are phenomenal. And if you disagree with anything of what I've said, I would love to listen from you.
Very good. That's the right attitude to have. Thank you so much indeed for coming along today and joining us to, as I say, talk about something that's extraordinarily important and an indication of how the industry is growing. We wish you the best for what we're doing. I know already Nitin knows and has already engaged with your firm as solid part of endorsement. We're delighted to have you on. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Guillermo, for sharing your thoughts and also sharing your leadership and your forward thinking in this space. Certainly very important, and I certainly wish you luck. I'll be in the journey with you. I promise that. And looking forward to catching up with you at some point in New York.
Please.
So take care, and thanks
Thank
for
you
coming
both
over.
and to your audience for the space and for the interest. Lovely to be here.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed our weekly conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or suggested topics, please contact Nitin Gaur or myself on the emails displayed here or via our LinkedIn profiles. Feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. Stay well, inquisitive, and engaged. See you next week.